Welcome to episode 36 of EFZ Talking Finance. This edition features a special AI-generated summary produced with Notebook LM, distilling Moody's latest analysis on speculative-grade credit into a listener-friendly audio format. The episode titled Weak Liquidity Weighs on Credit Quality More Than Good Liquidity Supports It unpacks the critical insights from Moody's guest article in the Funding and Treasury Study 2025. For lower-rated issuers, liquidity strengths and cash flow visibility matter more for credit quality than leverage metrics alone. Based on the July 2025 liquidity assessments across B3 and CAA1 issuers, Moody's shows that a weak liquidity is often a harbinger of distress, even when nominal leverage looks manageable. This content is highly relevant for CFOs, group treasurers, and credit analysts seeking to understand how rating agencies weigh liquidity, refinancing risk, and free cash flow sustainability in the current cycle. In a market where refinancing windows can close abruptly, the ability to generate steady operating cash flow and maintain flexible liquidity buffers has become the true differentiator between stability and downgrade risk. Tune in for a focused intelligence brief on what drives corporate credit resilience today, why treasurers should rethink liquidity strategies beyond leverage ratio.
Welcome to the Deep Dive. We are going straight into the heart of corporate risk management today. Our mission, to really unpack how credit quality gets assessed way down at the risky end of the spectrum. We're talking speculative grade companies, you know, the ones often linked with junk bonds. And we've been digging through quite a bit of proprietary research. And honestly, the findings challenge a pretty core assumption many investors make. What we found is that when you're looking at these lower rated issuers, think B3s, CAS1s, liquidity, which is, you know, immediate cash flow and reserves, often sends a stronger signal about immediate default risk than the traditional stuff like leverage ratios, how much debt they actually carry.
Yeah, it's one of the real paradoxes you see in low-end credit analysis. I mean, when a company is really teetering, the fact that its debt is high is almost secondary. What matters right now is whether it can pay its next bill. For companies rated B3 or KA1, weak liquidity isn't just like a minor concern. It is the single most common precursor to either a non-payment default or, you know, one of those distressed debt exchanges. If that cash window slams shut, well, the game's pretty much over.
Right.
Now, it is important to differentiate here. If you move up the ladder a bit in speculative grade, say, to the BAVE rating, well, adequate liquidity is kind of expected. It's table stakes. Having a huge cash pile doesn't necessarily boost a BAVE rating much further. But down at the bottom, B3 and below, the absence of decent liquidity, that's often the trigger for a downgrade, or worse. The rating agency approach really recognizes that survival, especially in that volatile space, is often a cash flow problem first, and maybe a debt problem second. Okay, yeah, that makes sense conceptually. Survival needs cash, obviously. But let's unpack what liquidity truly means here, because just glancing at the cash line on a balance sheet, that's clearly not enough, right?
Exactly.
What are the rating agencies actually looking at when they put companies into these boxes? Weak, adequate, good, or very good liquidity?
Right. It's a pretty holistic assessment, and it's forward-looking, usually looking out, say, the next 12 months. What they're really looking for is the certainty of funding. And the analysis usually breaks down into four main components.
Okay.
First is internal sources. This one's pretty straightforward. How much cash does the company actually have right now? And what's its expected free cash flow generation look like? Can they cover all their operating costs and mandatory debt payments just with the money they make themselves?
Mm-hmm.
Second is external sources.
Yeah.
This is about how much they rely on, say, committed bank facilities like revolving credit lines or RCFs. And crucially, the size and the certainty of those commitments. Are these reliable banks? Are the lines truly available? Okay, so how solid is that backup plan?
Precisely. Third, and this one is really critical, is covenant compliance. You know, a loan commitment is only useful if you can actually draw on it. So analysts look really hard at the cushion the company has before it might trip a loan covenant, like a leverage covenant or interest coverage. If they're getting close to breaching one of those metrics, that external liquidity could just poof, vanish overnight.
Ah, so the conditions attached matter hugely.
Absolutely. And then finally, there's alternate liquidity. Basically, do they have a plan B? This could be things like unencumbered assets, assets without liquidins that could be sold pretty quickly or maybe used as collateral to get some emergency financing.
Okay, so based on those four things, they get put in a category. You mentioned the extremes earlier. What's the real difference between, say, very good and weak?
Yeah, think about the two ends of the spectrum. If a company gets a very good liquidity rating, it basically means they are highly likely to meet all their obligations over the next year using only their internal cash and the cash flow they generate, without even needing to touch their bank lines. That shows real resilience.
Right, self-sufficient.
Exactly. Now, contrast that with weak liquidity. That classification means the company is actually relying on external financing just to cover mandatory payments, like interest or upcoming debt maturities. And, crucially, the availability of that external financing is considered highly uncertain. Maybe the RCF is too small, or maybe, and this is common, they're sailing really close to the wind on their covenants.
So weak means you are basically one bad quarter away from a potential crisis.
That's a good way to put it. The certainty just isn't there.
That distinction. Certainty versus uncertainty, that feels like the key market signal we need to hone in on. Let's look at some of that proprietary data you mentioned from July 2025. It compares B3 and KA1 rated issuers globally. The difference is pretty stark, isn't it?
It really is staggering. If you look at the B3 issuers around the world, only about 5% of them had a weak liquidity assessment.
Only 5%.
Yeah. So that tells you, even though they're low rated, often pretty indebted, the vast majority, 95%, have basically sorted out their short-term funding needs for the next year or so.
Okay. Now, KA1.
Now, look at KA1. It's a completely different story.
Yeah.
A massive 37% of KA1 issuers globally had a weak liquidity assessment.
Wow, 37%. That's huge.
It's an enormous slice of that rating category just operating without a reliable safety net. It's, what, almost 8 times the rate you see in the B3 category?
37%. That just screams danger zone. That feels like a flashing red light for future default rates, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. And you can flip the comparison, too. Look at the positive side.
Okay.
Only 9% of those KA1 issuers had good liquidity or better. Just 9% felt truly comfortable from a cash perspective.
Mm.
Meanwhile, for the B3 issuers, 38% had good liquidity or better.
38%. Much healthier.
Much healthier. It strongly suggests that liquidity acts as this immediate firewall. You know, if your underlying business is maybe a bit weak, but you've got the cash buffer, you might hold on to that B3 rating, stability-wise. But if you don't have that cash buffer, you risk plummeting into that KA1 danger zone pretty quickly.
Okay, so this is where the findings get really interesting, right? Where you see liquidity sometimes just completely overriding the traditional alarm bell of high debt. This is what you call the leverage illusion. The source is compared to pretty counterintuitive groups, using 7x debt to EBITDA as the dividing line for high leverage.
Exactly. We're basically comparing companies with seemingly manageable debt levels that are failing versus companies with objectively high debt that are somehow surviving, for now at least.
Right.
So first, let's look at the KA1 issuers who actually had lower leverage. Their debt to EBITDA was below 7x. You might think, okay, their debt's not crazy high, maybe they're relatively safe.
Yeah, that's the logical assumption.
But nope. 48%, almost half of that low-leverage KA1 group, still ended up with a weak liquidity assessment.
48%?
Yeah.
Even with lower debt?
Even with lower debt.
Mm.
And only about 7% of them managed to get good liquidity. So their debt metrics might have looked okay on paper, maybe even manageable, but they were effectively insolvent in the short term because they just couldn't fund their day-to-day operations or meet upcoming maturities. The cash wasn't there.
So that low leverage number was totally misleading in predicting immediate risk. They were functionally distressed anyway.
Absolutely. Now let's flip it. Let's look at the B3 issuers who had higher leverage debt above that 7x EBITDA threshold. This is the kind of debt level that usually makes investors really nervous.
Yeah, 7x plus is definitely high yield territory headache.
It is. But despite this massive debt load, only 2%, just 2% of this high-lever B3 group had a weak liquidity assessment.
Only 2%? That's incredible.
Incredible. And even better, more than 40% of them scored good or better on liquidity.
Hold on, let me get this straight. 40% of the high-levered B3 companies were demonstrably safer from an immediate survival perspective than the low-levered KA1 companies.
That's exactly what the data shows.
That completely turns the traditional view on its head. Why isn't the market panicking more about those B3s lugging around 7x or more debt?
Well, because that high leverage, while definitely a long-term risk that needs managing, isn't necessarily an immediate survival threat for them. Their liquidity, the certainty of their near-term cash flow, their access to those committed bank lines, it gives them a runway, sometimes a surprisingly long runway. The rating agencies are sort of implicitly saying, okay, yes, you've got way too much debt on the books, but you also have, say, 18 months of guaranteed operational funding to figure it out. Meanwhile, those KO1s, even the ones with lower debt, might only have, you know, 3 or maybe 6 months of funding certainty left before they hit a wall.
That makes the distinction crystal clear. The rating, especially down there, is really driven by the ability to survive the next year, not necessarily the absolute optimal debt structure 5 years out.
Precisely. And we can actually see this playing out with a couple of real-world examples. Two European speculative grade issuers, Olympic and Panzani, they illustrate this perfectly.
Okay, let's dig into those. Let's start with the cautionary tale, maybe. Olympic, the online gaming operator, they were rated Kaya 1 negative. What did their debt picture look like?
Right, so Olympic, their leverage, looking at the numbers from December 2024, was actually relatively low for the sector, just 5.0x debt-bida.
Five times. Objectively, you'd think that might put them higher, maybe a Sable B3.
You would think so based on leverage alone. However, the absolute core issue for them was pure liquidity risk. They had some operational underperformance, particularly in their land-based casinos, and that really hammered their free cash flow generation. Their internal cash reserves just weren't going to be enough to meet a really critical upcoming payment, a EUR 200 million bond maturity due in December 2025.
Okay, a big cliff edge coming up.
A very big cliff edge. They couldn't fund it internally, and crucially, they couldn't guarantee they'd be able to access the external markets to refinance it, given their performance. So this refinancing risk, driven entirely by that immediate cash shortfall, was basically the sole reason for that very low K1 rating, despite the moderate leverage.
Looked okay on the leverage metric, but couldn't actually find the cash to pay the upcoming bill.
Right.
Classic liquidity crunch.
Exactly. Now, contrast that with the French food maker, Panzani. They were rated B3 stable.
Okay, Panzani. B3 stable.
Panzani is almost the poster child for this whole leverage illusion concept. Their leverage was exceptionally high. It peaked at a massive 9.0x debt-EBITDA in December 2024.
Nine times. Whoa.
Nine times. And this was largely because they did a dividend recapitalization, basically. The company intentionally took on a bunch of new debt just so it could pay out a large cash dividend to its private equity owners.
Right, loading up the company with debt to pay the owners.
Yeah.
Nine times sounds like a ticking time bomb. Isn't that kind of debt structure usually seen as a huge red flag? How on earth does a rating agency justify keeping them at B3 stable with that kind of number?
Yeah, it's a fair question. It's justified almost entirely by their exceptional and, importantly, very stable liquidity position.
The liquidity again.
Panzani sells staple food products, pasta, sauces, that sort of thing. Stuff people buy regardless of the economy. So they have very stable demand and highly predictable cash flow. They just don't need a massive buffer against, say, cyclical downturns like some other industries do.
Okay, stable business helps.
Yeah.
But the numbers.
More importantly, their actual liquidity numbers were fantastic. As of that same period, they held EUR 165 million in cash on their balance sheet.
Okay.
And they also had access to a fully committed EUR 70 million revolving credit facility, RCF.
So add those up.
That's EUR 235 million of guaranteed certain available liquidity. Now compare that to their 2024 EBITDA, which was around EUR 73 million. That liquidity buffer is more than three times their annual earnings.
Pretense earnings just sitting there available.
Exactly. That incredibly robust liquidity is what supports the B3 stable rating. It gives management a really long runway, easily a year, probably more, to just operate the business smoothly and figure out a strategy to gradually bring down that 9x debt load over time.
So Olympic failed because of immediate cash flow uncertainty, even with only 5x debt. Panzani survives and gets a stable rating because of the certainty of its massive cash buffer, even while carrying 9x debt. It really hammers home the point. Down to the bottom end of the credit spectrum, it's access to oxygen in the cash, not necessarily how heavy your backpack the debt that defines whether you survive the next climb.
Yeah.
Okay, let's transition a bit. As we hinted at earlier, this almost obsessive focus on near-term liquidity doesn't necessarily apply quite the same way as you move up the credit scale. What changes when we look at, say, higher speculative grade companies? like Bay 2 and B3 issuers.
Right. Well, at those Bay ratings, the intense focus on just liquidity tends to diminish somewhat. And that's largely because, almost by definition, most companies rated Bay already have adequate or better liquidity. If they didn't, they probably wouldn't be rated Bay in the first place. If you look at the distribution of liquidity assessments across Bay 2 and Bay 3 rated companies, it's not substantially different between the two. Most are adequate or good. Weak is rare.
So adequate liquidity is kind of assumed at that level.
It's largely assumed, yes. At that point, the market and the rating agencies tend to shift their focus back towards more longer-term structural factors that determine credit quality over time. Things like the inherent strength of the company's actual business profile, its market position, its competitive advantages, also the overall industry and economic environment they operate in, and really importantly, their long-term financial policy.
Yeah.
You know, is management committed to reducing debt over time, or do they have a history of, say, leveraging up for acquisitions or shareholder returns like Panzani did, but maybe without Panzani's liquidity buffer?
So bigger picture stuff comes back into play.
Exactly. Those factors tend to dictate the rating stability over a period of years, not just the next few months. But, and this is an important caveat, we have to remember liquidity is always potentially existential. Even for a seemingly solid, better-rated company, if there was a sudden, sharp, and really unexpected deterioration in their liquidity, maybe a major bank pulls its credit line unexpectedly, or a huge lawsuit suddenly freezes their assets, that would immediately weigh very negatively on their credit quality, because that immediate risk of not being able to pay bills can suddenly override almost every other structural strength they might possess.
Yeah, the threat of immediate collapse trumps everything else until that threat is resolved. It's like the ultimate triage for credit quality assessment.
Well put.
So wrapping this up, what does this all mean for you, our listener? Well, our deep dive today really confirms a crucial maxim, especially if you're involved in high-yield investing or credit analysis. When you're looking at companies teetering near the edge of distress, survival is often defined less by how high their total debt burden is, and much more by the certainty of their short-term cash runway. You know, their operating cash flow plus guaranteed access to external funding like those RCFs. If you really want to figure out who's likely to survive a downturn, you need to find the companies with the most oxygen, the most certain liquidity.
Yeah, and that brings us back to that really critical data point we uncovered earlier. If liquidity is truly the key determinant of immediate survival at the low end, and if, as of July 2025, a huge 37% of all Care 1 issuers globally had weak liquidity assessments, well, that represents a very large segment of the market facing severe immediate pressure. What that high proportion might be telling us is that there's a large pool of low-rated companies currently operating without much of a safety net, which means if operational pressures continue or if high interest rates keep biting, we should probably anticipate seeing future default rates rising significantly, specifically among that exposed Care 1 group. It really highlights where the next potential wave of defaults is likely to originate from.